Welcome back to another episode of Here and There, the podcast of the Germanic American Institute. This is Günther hosting one more time. We are recording this episode just prior to Deutsche Tage, released after Deutsche Tage. So there's a little bit of a gap in there. And the significance of this is actually that if you are on the volunteer team, you had access to a keg specially delivered by Utepils out of Minneapolis, or just outside of Minneapolis. And how Utepils actually came to us is what we'll talk about today. This is the podcast of the Germanic American Institute.
Welcome. Willkommen.
Where Germanic-speaking European countries...
Germany.
Deutschland.
Austria.
Österreich.
Switzerland.
Schweiz.
Blend with the Midwestern United States.
Hallo.
Servus.
Grüezi.
We are here and there. And we invite you to come along on the journey. All right. And it is all about beer. And if you are catching on to the idea that there is a huge smile on my face, it's not just because of the beer. I'm just going to dish it out as it is. This is the second round of recording this exact portion of the podcast, because the first time around, yours truly forgot to hit record. Welcome to Behind the Scenes, but also welcome to Dan of Utepils. Thank you for joining us, Dan.
It's a wonderful experience being here.
And, well, thank you, particularly now on round two. And we have Erin as well. Erin, good to see you again.
You too.
We are recording this at the GEI, which is where Deutsche Tage just took place. Of course, retroactively, we hope that you enjoyed the festivity of seeing everybody again, and you are using this as a prep phase, if you will, for what will be the Oktoberfest. Of course, more details to be announced about that, and also then, of course, towards the end of the podcast with the website and so forth. You know the drill. Let's hand it over to Dan real quick and catch up on the 20 minutes that we just lost of recording. I do want to go back, essentially rewinding the wheel, so to speak, a little bit, the reel, as to how did Utepils come to its name?
So it's an interesting story, and I believe stories are what really matters. It was a case of road rage. My wife and I were driving to the cabin on Memorial Day weekend, and we were stuck in traffic, and I was getting a little tense, and so she decided to read things off the internet to me, and one of the things she found to read was an article that said there are just particular 10 words that don't translate well into English, and so as she started reading through them, one of the words she hit was Utepils, which is actually Norwegian, and we just laughed and smiled. And every time we used the word that weekend with our friends, we found no one can say it without smiling.
When was that?
It's in 2014.
It was in 2014, so about 7 years ago, give or take.
Yes.
And then Utepils became to actually be a brewery, but something happened in between, I suppose, between road rage and brewery.
I feel like we also need the meaning of Utepils, because you and I were so off.
Good point.
You were so off. We thought Utepils. So I was thinking the same thing that Günther was, which was that pils like for beer, and Ute like the German name, kind of old school, 70s, 80s.
Yeah, 70s, 80s, Ute, common German name, I would suppose, at that point.
I knew an Ute in Germany. Didn't even know a few.
Yeah.
But what is Utepils?
Yeah.
I tried.
Yeah.
You can't Utepils. Say it without smiling.
It's not Utepils, the German pronunciation. It's
correct.
It's Utepils. So there's a little bit of Norwegian influence, obviously.
It's a Norwegian word. So, yes, if you can ham it up a little bit and go Utepils, you'll have fun with it.
It's pretty fun.
But no, Utepils is wonderful because it describes an emotion that I suspect everybody listening has felt, if they like beer. But it is the joy and anticipation to enjoy that first beer after a long, cold, dark winter. So when in February you've got your nose pressed to the glass and you're dreaming of a cold beer and your toes in the grass instead of being indoors, you're experiencing the emotion of Utepils. So we kind of think of it as anytime you've had to survive a long dark period and you get to celebrate by stepping out into the light with your friends with a beer. So if you want to compare that to winter, which the Norwegians came up with the name, or you can compare it to a pandemic,
right,
or you may compare it to that last meeting that you had with the board of directors,
right.
You know, whatever you want to do.
It's a fantastic trivia question, actually, by the way. What is the meaning of Utepils?
I know. Yeah. I'm
it's the $1 million question that nobody can answer.
It's burned into my brain now.
So that's it's more of a meaning to the general public. And if you Google it, a pure reductionist translation would be outside beer. But if you take the colloquial meaning that it means to actual consumers and people who live there, that's what they think of. It's a kind of a folk meaning.
Okay. Why are you pointing at me?
Oh, I thought you had another question. See, these are the things that we edit in the back end that nobody gets to hear. I'm actually on the fence to even take the first reference out. But the question from earlier still, between the road rage and the inception of Utebils as a functional company, how did you actually get from the, I want to go faster to, let's brew beer under this name?
Yeah, no, great question. So when we picked that name after that weekend, that was just kind of the holding company, and I was busy writing a business plan. And so between creating a business plan, then you have to discover what you don't know, because the best way to learn something is to have to teach it. So if you're writing a business plan, you're basically writing your lesson plan to how to convince other people to give you their money.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to explain how you're going to do that and how it's going to work. So I spent a lot of time interviewing people who knew things in the industry that I didn't know, although I'd been in the industry for 10 years. That did give me a really great resource of who to call and who to talk to. And those people, many of ended up becoming part of the original team of Utebils. So found my brewer that way, found my director of sales, found my taproom manager. All people that became part of the core operating team were found through me trying to teach myself more about aspects of the industry that I wasn't primarily familiar with.
So from the get-go, you actually had in mind to be more than quote-unquote a home brewing operation. You actually wanted to create something of larger footprint.
Oh, yes. I had previously co-owned Vine Park Brewing Company over here in St. Paul, which I spent 10 years helping people learn how to homebrew.
Or at least
pretend they knew how to homebrew. And what I wanted to do is I saw it as being part of the Minnesota craft industry at that time. I saw where it was going to go, and I thought we should take advantage of it. That didn't work out for us as Vine Park, so I sold my interest to my partner, and that was my seed money to go start what became Utebils. So started with that, got some early core investors, and then we did a unique kind of fundraising operation and found a site. And that was one of the more complicated things, is finding a site that was worthy of what we wanted to do. But I had a dream of creating a place that was somewhat timeless, a brewery that people would drive past other breweries to go to, and one that would embrace what I call European style. And I leave it open because it's not just European-style beers, but it's a way of approaching European-style drinking where it's just was different than what I grew up here in the United States with, and an approach and a comfortability with having a beer. And so to me, the essence of that was the beer gardens that I experienced in Bavaria. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to find a place where people would, we could bring the ethos of what we were creating, delicious beers that weren't high in alcohol, that were sessionable, that were, in my mind, kind of eddies in a current. I didn't want to get on the treadmill of trying to create a new beer every week. What I wanted to do is if a beer style had lasted 20, 30, or 50 years, then it probably had proved itself. So what we brew are classic European-style beers. And we put them in an environment where, in our tap room, you can enjoy those. And we, you know, kind of let you create those same experiences in your home or wherever you go, or out in bars and restaurants where you can purchase our product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we talked about this pre-recording, but your location and outdoor facility is absolutely amazing. And one thing I wanted to talk about too was, you know, as the pandemic was ending, I think I saw on social media just that Utebils, it seemed to me like, was one of the only places that was open, that was continually changing your outside configuration to make things safe for people. And it looked like everyone was having fun, like bundled up with their beers. So I wanted you to talk about that a little, because it just seemed really different to me.
Thank you. We really started with the idea that always with the business, and I hammer it home to all of our people, we make beer. But what we sell is fun. We sell an experience, right? You know, once you drink the beer, it's gone not too long afterwards. But what makes you want to repeat it is that sparkle of excitement in your brain, the fun that you had when you were doing it. And that fun can be as simple as you're in your fishing boat and you open up the cooler and you pull out a can of beer to offer it to your buddy, and they give you that look like you just pulled a dead skunk out, you know, you're going, ooh. And then, or if you pull that can of beer out and they go, oh, I like that beer. I've heard of that. I want that. And inside you just get that little, yeah, I do. I picked the right beer. And you want to do that again. So what we did with the tap room, because that's the most visible way, and honestly, during the pandemic, our primary way of making any kind of revenue, was to embrace the fact that we had to give people safety. We had to, because without safety, you can't relax. And without relaxation, you can't have fun. So what we did was really lean heavily into making sure that people walked into an environment, which is the only thing we have a chance to control, and create an experience for them. We needed to create a stage and a place. And so we really leaned heavily into the winter, took some risks, creating what we called our winter garden instead of the beer garden. And I have to say, we were uniquely positioned to really do that well. We have an incredibly large tap room with spacious ceilings. We have always had ceiling fans moving the air. We really have no walls in the brewery. So while that can lead to some noise, it also means that we had 18,000 square feet times 22 jillion volume of air that is constantly circulating there. People felt safe in that environment. And we have this amazing beer garden. The brewery itself is located just outside of downtown Minneapolis on the border of Golden Valley and Minneapolis. So there's Theater Worth Park. And then there's two other parks on the other two sides of our site. We are literally surrounded on all three sides by parkland. Bassett Creek flows through there. So it goes right past the brewery and then wraps around the beer garden. So on any given day, you might be startled by a deer, see bald eagles. And at the same time, you can see the downtown skyline a mile away. It's unique.
So before we go back to beer, I think there are some really interesting business lessons in here that a lot of entrepreneurs, business owners have struggled with prior to COVID already, certainly during COVID, and perhaps now for those who are still operative after COVID, is the idea of selling an experience more so than a product, or essentially tying the experience to the product. How did you go about conceptualizing all this, and how did you somehow figure out that this risk is manageable and produce and position something that actually stands in an environment that is so ambiguous as the pandemic, that is so uncertain that we don't know where to go, how to get there, much less how to stay there, and like you said, feel safe. How did all this come together? I mean, where were those connection points where you said, this is it, this is going to work?
It's an interesting question to try to wrap my head around it, and I haven't per se thought of it that way, but what I can tell you is that I am probably the dumbest person at the table. Not just here, but also in the brewery. I hire people who know much more about what they need to do for me. I'm comfortable with that. I know I'm not the brewer. I know I'm not the best salesperson. I know I'm not the accountant. What I do is always look at beer as a patron, as the consumer. And so I'm also now 62 years old. So when I think about going out for a beer during the pandemic, it was very clear to me, long before the younger people at the brewery got it, we need to take control of our environment. I've always felt that way about what we do. From day one, we've always talked about we sell an experience. So we need to make sure that people can walk in and there's enough boundaries that they feel safe. And so that was just really a constant thing, because I knew, as in my life and the people that I were talking to, what they were comfortable doing, what they weren't comfortable doing. And so it was driven by the need to, how would a consumer react walking in the door? When we would talk about what we were going to do or how we would have to change it, when the rules would change, I would say, put yourself in the parking lot and start walking in the door. What do you need to see to understand what the next step is so that I'm not, okay, honey, what do we do? What do we do next? I didn't want anybody doing that. Oh, and I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. Okay, I go to the left, I do this. Okay, it's just like telling people where the bathrooms are. You take the stress away. You know, if you force people to ask you where the bathrooms are, that's just like, oh, I don't hate want to do that. So you put up signs. So, you know, we were very vigorous about putting up signage. We put up aisleways. We cleared out tables. We made it very visible what it was okay and how to flow through the operation. And the more important thing that we did is we embraced fail fast. So we would try something, and if it wasn't working, we'd start over and watch how people were reacting. I think those are the two biggest things. And remember that the consumer is your consumer, and you have to help them. And you also have to realize none of us are as smart as we hope we are. So change. If it's not working, it's so obvious to me. It's just like when you don't proof your own writing because you see what you want to say. You have somebody else look at it. And so your consumer is that somebody else looking at what you think you just did. And they're going, I don't know where the bathroom is. You know, so clearly we're not doing what we thought we were doing. So in everything that we do, we try to listen and watch what's happening. And if we see smiles, you know, one of the things we did during COVID was we turned off our TVs. Because honestly, it was $600 a month paying for all the different services and fees and licenses as a business. And I'm like, I can't afford that. Mm-hmm. I'd rather pay somebody. Right. So we've turned them off. We've never turned them back on.
That's awesome. I didn't notice that when I was there last week, but I like that.
And that's perfect because you know what? No one ever noticed the TVs. Yeah. The only people who looked at them were the bartenders, right? Because they were trying to keep track of the Twins game or something. When people come to our place, and I can't explain how it occurs, but whatever the feng shui is or the proper pronunciation of that, people come to our place and they do exactly what I dreamed they would do. They talk to each other. They tell stories. They interact. Despite being a large place, it seems comfortable when there's a few people and it seems comfortable when there's a crowd. Mm-hmm. People interact with each other and stories are the basis of all of that. One of the things I tell people and they're always surprised by is I don't care. I don't even want you to be talking about my beer when you're at the table. And if you want to, if that's truly your gig and you want to try to debate and figure out which kind of hop my brewery used in there, go ahead and do that. But honestly, I just want you to get about 2/3 of the way through and go, God, that's good. I want another one. But so we were talking about that vacation. Or do you remember that story I was telling about? There are more important things in life than beer. It's all those people that you're interacting with are more important. My beer is just supposed to set the table and be so delicious you can't imagine going somebody else, but you don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, I feel like that seems to me like in the European mindset or like what the vibe that I had when I was at German Beer Gardens. That we, I think, even try to simulate here at the GAI.
Yeah.
With our events.
We don't, we're as geeky as any brewery in town. All these people that are making, you know, sours and different beers, and they're super out in front about how they make their beers geeky, mm-hmm. you know, and different, and try to come up with a new thing and all of that. We're like that inside. And one of the products that I don't use is Apple. But what I love about Apple products is, to the people who like them, they appear super simple. They never talk about the technology really inside them. They talk about how they make your life better and how easy they are and how cool you'll be for using it. So I can chat to chapter and verse and say, you know, all of our Kolsch, we literally bring in the grain that we use to make that beer from farms around the city of Köln because that's what a true Kolsch brewer would use. Mm-hmm. We don't use anything else. If you want to know about our Pilsner that I brought over for the volunteers and they enjoyed so much, we literally bring those hops in from a hop cooperative that we found in Bohemia that didn't normally export those varieties to the United States. We cut a deal with them to bring them in because that was what we wanted to create. We're incredibly authentic in what we use for our ingredients. We also are on a site which uses artesian spring water, so all of the beers are brewed with artesian well water. But we don't talk about a lot.
Yeah,
we talk about the indescribably good experiences that you'll have.
Yeah, it's interesting that everything you describe basically leaves the complexity of the process and the complexity of what actually goes into the product by the wayside and creates a positive experience hinging on simplicity.
Yes.
That
indescribably
is
good.
Yeah, I think this is almost counterintuitive to what many other brewers are doing, who pride themselves on their probably impeccable craftsmanship and perhaps speak to a market segment, although smaller, that really understands what goes in there. You're going sort of the opposite direction, in a sense, still producing and providing the same quality, but with
a simplified
mindset. Much better quality. Okay, let's talk about quality, because, of course, that Einheitsgebot.
Yes.
As the listening audience cannot see my wagging finger right now, but the Reinheitsgebot obviously is the measure of all beer things in Austria and Germany, and I would say probably across the world of those who consider themselves authentic beer brewers. And I'm sure you follow the same pattern.
We do. We have been brewing now since 2017, and this year we produced our first 900 Reinheitsgebot beer. We actually added fruit to our Pontoon Afternoon, which is a raspberry-tinted Kolsch. So we deviated a little bit, but that's what you do in the summertime. You go on vacation and you do things that are a little wild and crazy. But everything else that we do is very traditional. And, the reality is we use those ingredients that I talked briefly about from Europe, not because they're cheaper, they're more expensive, but we use them because they're better. So using a floor malted barley is better. Mm-hmm. When it's a situation where the input isn't better, we find the better one. So if you come in and you've been there and you've seen the brewery, it's an amazingly beautiful machine in terms of actually the beer brewing process. It was custom built for us in Bavaria based on the styles of beers that we wanted to create. It's probably one of the most high-tech breweries in the United States. It's computer controlled. We use an energy saving technology in there on the brew house side that's never been used before in North America in a commercial brewery. We've had brewers fly in from as far away as Hawaii to tour it and take a look at it as they consider whether they're going to bring that same technology to their new brewery. Our roof is covered with solar panels. We embrace technology to make a better beer. Mm-hmm. We're not stick in the woods. We're not using an old copper pot and a wood fire underneath there, because that's the old way. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we use the better thing when it's the better thing. We're not hung up about using something new or something old. If it's better, that's the thing we use. We just don't spend a lot of time outside of podcasts talking about it, because the right. average consumer may only drink beer once or twice a year. When they do, they're just expecting it to be good. And you mentioned earlier a conversation, a item about the craft beer industry.
Yeah.
And I firmly believe we are in the post-craft beer world.
Okay.
And what I mean by that is, if I ask you to write down on a piece of paper what the definition of craft is, I'm pretty confident when we open your two envelopes up, they won't agree. And if I go to the Brewers Association of America, and I asked them what the definition of craft beer is, they would tell you that Shell's Brewery that opened in 1858 doesn't qualify as a craft brewery under their definition. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, they change their definition every year so that whenever Sam Adams gets a little bit bigger, they can still include Sam Adams as a craft brewery because they want to show that craft beer is growing. Right.
Sure.
So the definition never changes. It always changes.
Okay.
Right. But if I tell you, my theory is that we're in the delicious beer era.
That sounds like a good era.
Because if you put it in your mouth and you say, it's delicious, you didn't have to ask anybody's permission or you didn't have to understand. You can just say, this beer is delicious to me. I don't have to get hung up on the word craft.
But what's so intriguing about everything that you're saying is essentially that it's really all about the experience and just remembering what you've done while you were there, but it's actually beer. It's just a vessel that delivers, if you will.
Yes.
And that is, again, I'm finding myself stuck in terms of what question am I asking regarding beer when beer really is not the subject here. Beer is just the container, if you will, that contains everything that you take with, taking the experience with you, reliving this, gives us an entirely different spin.
So we embraced the whole Winter Garden thing, and we were very lucky, and we worked diligently to get earned media, which would be attention from TV stations and radio mm-hmm. and newspapers would talk about what we were doing in our beer garden, and a lot of people found us who just didn't know we existed.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was great. You know, it was wonderful help trying to survive, and I have to put a parenthesis in here and stop and say, we would not be here without the government. With sure. all of the aid programs that were yeah. created, we wouldn't be here. And I will tell you that almost all of the breweries in Minnesota would have closed.
Yep. Wow.
Because I know the owners of the breweries. Mm-hmm. So whatever happened, it did save a lot of us to get to this point. And now we have to save ourselves by selling beer and doing the right things. And I totally lost where I was going with this before the parentheses.
We were talking about the Winter Garden.
Ah, the Winter Garden.
Yes.
So the question was, the point being, I guess, would be that all these people discovered us, right? Mm-hmm. And if they didn't enjoy that experience, they wouldn't come back. And what we are seeing right now is we are having people coming back. They found an experience of sitting out in the cold, drinking our beer with their friends around fires, and said, I want to go back and see what that's like in the summertime. And they told their friends, and they've told their friends. And at this moment, in the last month, our tap room and beer garden has never been busier than since we opened the doors.
Yeah.
It's rather amazing. And part of that is that exuberance, maybe ooh to pills, of having survived a long, dark panic, pandemic.
I was there at 3:00 on a Wednesday. I was like, yeah, business meeting. And I was surprised at how many people were there. I was like, who are these people?
I really need your job. Are you hiring?
We could do this next one at our place.
I would. Yeah, I mean, the entire gear here is portable. I think we actually should. Particularly then giving you an account firsthand of what it actually really feels like to be there. But knowing what you know now, going back to 2014, starting Utabils, what would you do different?
Run to the mountains and stay away from this.
And that's exactly where I was going with this. Would you do it again?
I would do it in many ways very differently, or I might not do it at all. I mean, it was a debate my wife and I had at the time. She had a good corporate job, and you know, I would have probably needed to find something to do to keep me employed for a while. But we were on a fairly nice track for retirement. And we had the conversation, should we go, you know, live on the beaches in Costa Rica and goof off every day? And I said, no, I will just drink every day and get fat and I won't have anything to do and it'll just be terrible. And so we decided to live life as an adventure. It's been a little bit more of an adventure than we had kind of anticipated. This is what we do, and we are proud of what we are creating. And I believe the brewery will be there long after we are gone, and that it is making world-class beer here in Minnesota. It's introducing people to, you know, people are saying, you don't make weird beers. You don't make, you know, with something with pastries stuffed in it and, you know, this and that. And I tell you, on the other hand, if you're talking about a consumer that's never had a pastry stout, or they've never had a delicious actual Bavarian Hefeweizen. Mm-hmm. They're both new to them. Why don't you give them the new one, which was the old one, the Bavarian Hefeweizen, and a beer that has proven its worth on 500 years of popularity over a pastry stout that's had 14 minutes of popularity. It's new to most people. Most people drink macro lager. So all the stuff we make, and especially at the quality that we make it, is a totally new beer to those people.
So how many beers do you actually have on the menu?
As
mainstays?
Sure. We have about 6 that are year-round beers, and then we rotate in seasonal. So right now in the lagering tanks, there's our first batch of Receptional, our fest beer for Oktoberfest, which hopefully we'll drink some here. And, you know, we will drink at our place and in many places all over the state of Minnesota. We've gave the brewers some freedom this winter because obviously we weren't selling any beer to bars and restaurants that were mostly closed mm-hmm. or shut down to very minimal operations. So we had some extra fermentators. So we allowed the brewers to go make some unique beers. So we made a Rauchbier.
A Rauchbier?
Yes.
The smoked beer?
Yes.
Whoa.
Okay, tell me more. I'm intrigued because immediately the thought of smokehouse comes to mind.
Have you never had a smoked beer, the Rauchbier?
It's sorry, when it comes to beer, I lived a very sheltered existence, evidently.
So okay, history lesson, because I always go back to the story, right? And this is probably running too long for you, but...
Oh, no, keep going.
The reality is that every beer probably before, you know, the 1840s would be, in our terms, a smoked beer. Because when you make beer, you take barley, you malt it, which basically means that you germinate the seed, so it converts starches to sugar, and then you heat it up to kill the seed, which leaves the sugar unused by the plant. And that's how we get the sweetness that into the water that the yeast then eats and makes alcohol and flavors. But the ability, the technological ability to control the temperature and to roast that grain resulted from wood fires, coal fires. So there was always some smoke seeping through the grain. So almost mm-hmm. all the grain would have had a smoky flavor. All beers would have had a smoky flavor, just as all beers would have been brown. That was the great world-changing revolution of the Pilsner. Pilsner Urquell, the first one. Mm-hmm. They had gotten the technology to work with the grain so that they didn't burn any of it. And so you'd got this golden, beautiful yellow color, which tied in with the point that the general consuming public was now kind of wealthy enough to actually own glassware instead of stoneware.
Sure.
And they could see the beer. And this beautiful yellow color was so different than every other beer that was available in the marketplace for them. It was a huge competitive advantage. So circle around back to smoked beers. It's pretty much a thing that died out because it was considered a thing that was a flaw. You weren't using the most modern technology.
Sure.
So there are areas, particularly in Franconia and Bamberg, that specialize in smoked beers. They retain the old way of doing it. And so when you go there, you can almost all the beers will have a smoky flavor to it. So we made a smoked Märzen by using smoked grain.
Oh, interesting. Did people like it?
See, like I said, we get geeky. Is anybody about it? We just
no, but here's everything in me just right now screams to let's go out there and actually sample the beers and have a history lesson behind that because
let's do it.
I think it's so easy to consume, obviously, because it is so readily available. But to truly understand not the technology behind it, automation and whatnot, obviously with volume production makes sense. But the actual history behind it. So, for instance, smoked beer, I had no idea.
See, I've been to Bamberg. I've been everywhere in Germany. I used to live there, and I love it. And, yeah, I had friends who would do, like, the Bavarian breakfast, where I think you have the Rauchbier, the smoked beer with the white sausages mm-hmm. and the sweet mustard. Yeah.
Did you just say breakfast?
Yeah. These first.
But of course, beer for breakfast.
Yes.
Okay.
You can't drink all day if you don't start in the morning.
Right. That much
is
true.
I mean, it wasn't like a 7 a.m. I mean, this when I had it, it was at like 10.
So brunch. Okay.
She was out late the night before.
So I'm getting like very nostalgic. So I like to geek out on all things German.
Sure. No, that's fine.
So to your point about the history, every beer style literally comes from geography and history because of the reality of what ingredients were available to the local brewer, what was the water chemistry, mm-hmm. What were the ingredients they could afford to buy, what were the competitive pressures. Those reasons meant that a Pilsner was never going to be developed other than where it was because of the water chemistry. You couldn't make a Pilsner in England. The water chemistry simply wouldn't allow it. Now today, going back to an old point you talked about, is this the height of craft beer? Mm-hmm. In the United States, we have the ability to make, through technology, literally every kind of beer. And mm-hmm. if the brewer is good and they use good equipment and they have good ingredients, they can make fabulous versions. So, you know, in America, we're kind of the smorgasbord of beers, to think about it. Whereas if you're in Germany, you're going to have a certain palette of beers that are going to be offered to you. If you're in England, you're going to have a certain palette of beers. Same as if you're in the Czech Republic. Now that is spreading because styles and the technology for doing everything that we're doing in the U.S. can happen in these places also. So everywhere you go in Europe now, so when I travel there, everywhere has an IPA, as they call it, instead of an IPA.
Oh, thank you.
So when I traveled in the Czech Republic 15 years ago, there were no IPAs, you know, but now when you go there, every brewery is going to have one. You know, it is also the fun of going to those places is finding beer styles you didn't really know about or had never experienced. So one of my favorite beers that we make, and we've brought it out three different times now, is a black lager based on a Czech style. So when you think of the Czech Republic, you think of Pilsners, correct? Mm-hmm. Everybody, Czech Republic, Pilsners, Pilsners, Pilsners. But every brewery you go to there will have their house beer, which is a black lager. And in fact, there's Jufraku, which is in downtown Prague and has been there for about 600 years. And they have never made anything but a black lager. So it was a style that I was totally unaware of. I fell in love with it when I was there and came back and convinced my brewer that we should make it. And it is a fabulous beer. And people look at it and they are amazed because it looks so black. It's going to be like a stout. And if you put it in a stone mug where you couldn't see the color, you would never know. And it's just an amazingly delicious beer.
So and I could, We'll have to try them.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, so that's the fun is that we do get to experiment and we experiment from history because all of these things developed. And sometimes they died out, but you can go back and find the recipes.
So considering the ability to brew everything under the sun here in the U.S. with all kinds of technology that gives you predictability and outcome, does it actually even make sense to still buy a beer that's imported from, let's say, the Dutch or the Belgians? Or can you really get everything here and it doesn't even make any sense to go overseas anymore for that particular purchase?
That's a tricky question. It's almost like, would you say, is it worthwhile to buy French wine? Because you can buy amazing American wines. Well, yes and no. They also have delicious wines from France, and they're just different than the ones that you get here. So is it worthwhile to seek out Peroni from Italy? Probably not. Mm-hmm. But is it worthwhile to find Orval? Oh, yes. It's definitely worthwhile to find an Orval here in the United States, even though it's better when you're in Europe because it's fresher. I mean, that's one of the big differences between beer and wine, mm-hmm. is that wine is very stable. Mm-hmm. It will evolve in the bottle over time, but those times are measured in years. And for beer, those are generally measured in days and months. What we do at Uda Pils, to circle around back to me, because it's all about us, right?
yes, it is.
Yes.
Is our Bavarian Hefeweizen, mm-hmm. that we make. We bring all of those ingredients fresh from Europe, and then we brew the beer fresh here versus having it brewed there and put on a ship and take 6 months to get here to go through the whole distribution system,
right,
before only you buy it on a shelf. So it's really worthwhile to drink beer fresh. In most cases. Now, some very unique beers are brewed to age. Very high alcohol beers that approach alcohol levels of wine, those age very well. But for most people, and for most beers they're seeking out, you want to drink things that are fresh. It's like eating fresh fruit, a garden tomato versus a store-bought tomato.
Sure.
It's just the difference between knowing that what happened to that product and how it was made or grown to get to you at a semi-fresh level at the grocery store. Mm-hmm. So if you take our Bavarian Hefeweizen over to Munich and you pour it in a glass and you drink it next to some of the best Bavarian Hefeweizens in the world that are fresh, they compare very nicely. Mm-hmm. Now, I would say here, drinking one that's fresh from our brewery compared to one that's been sitting for months, waiting to get here, waiting to get tapped, waiting to get poured, I think ours tastes better. Every single thing, every single beer. I'm not going to say that. I'm not that crazy. But I'm just saying, in general, mm-hmm. a fresh beer brewed just the way it would be brewed there is better than a beer brewed there and put in storage for months.
Makes sense.
Part of the joy that you have here is that you are selling the connection to the Germanic experience. And so by bringing in brand names that are very traditional and associated with that, that is part of that experience when they are sitting in your Rathskeller and having a beer here, having a beer that is tied to a brand they recognize and honor as being amazingly good, that's part of that experience that you sell, is you give them comfort.
And this is where my head, again, is going back full circle with you, actually, because at the end of the day, it comes down to be the experience, because I would argue, and I'm inviting you to send hate mail to podcast@gaimn.org, please. I would argue that the majority of beer consumers really does not have an educated enough palate to truly discern the difference to the degree that they can name what the differences are.
You are absolutely correct. They probably don't even have the vocabulary.
Right.
They may perceive it, but they can't express it.
Right.
Because they just haven't been educated in that sense of those things. And in the abstract, you having one single beer and trying, or two beers and comparing the two, it's very difficult. But let's say we take 2 million people and have them try two beers 50 million times and rate them. Mm-hmm. And the law of numbers will tell us that overall, the better beer will be perceived, even though people couldn't describe why they like the one on this side better. They will pick it more often than the beers that are of lesser quality. As they experience the beers over and over again, they will notice, I'm just happier with this one in my mouth. It's a little bit more delicious. It's not more bitter. It's not more this. It's just a little bit more delicious. And so I choose that one more frequently than that one. And that's as complicated as it needs to be.
I wonder whether this is then also ambiance depending. Sure. So if we can have two beers, one perceivably or technically being superior, served in a lesser ambiance versus the one that is perhaps inferior in quality, production value, what have you, served in the better ambiance with just more touch and feel, and arguably that beer would likely rank better because it's not just the consumption of the beer, it's the consumption of the environment.
The best wines that I've ever had have been sitting with my wife.
Who is undoubtedly listening to this podcast. And you well done.
It is that experience that matters. And so if I'm having a very good bottle of wine with her, mm-hmm. and then I have a even better bottle of wine with some grumpy old person that I'm not having a good time with, I'm going to really remember the bottle of beer with my or wine with my wife as a better experience, and thus I will want to think that I will buy that product because I will think the product was better. That will be my association with that moment. And so that is why I always talk about it's the moment, it's the experience. Our job is to create a way to let, in a sense, the stage. Yeah. We create a stage, we put some stuff out there, and then it's you guys that get to go and have your, you know, what do they call it, when you just get up there and start making things up. On the stage.
Improv.
So life is improv, and my job is to create a stage
yeah.
that has the things and stuff sitting out there that you can choose to interact with that gives you the best experience and puts on the best show. I don't write your words. You do that. I just give you a place to have the best possible experience. Whether it's my place, your kitchen, your backyard, when you crack open one of our cans of beer, or two, or three, around the fire. And maybe you're not in my winter garden, but you're in your own backyard winter garden, or you're in my, you know, by my creekside beer garden, or you're at your cabin, or you're out on your pontoon and cracking open a pontoon afternoon beer. My job is just to make you smile.
I think on that note, we'll wrap this. This is the highest note we can possibly find.
Excellent.
Dan, there will be more of this. There will certainly be beer from Utebils at future events, hopefully, of course, at the Oktoberfest. Thank you for stopping by.
Well, thank you for letting me have so much fun here.
Do I get to do a promo of upcoming events?
Do you want to?
Yes.
Do we have something?
Yes.
Then, of course.
Do I get to do a promo of upcoming
sure.
events?
Let's both.
Let's do that. I didn't think we had any. Okay.
We do. We have
all right.
Tons of upcoming events.
Okay. Upcoming events. Erin.
Should I do my spiel first or should we let our guests go?
You're more prepared.
True.
although, to be honest, this particular recording suggests anything but.
Maybe let's have Dan go first.
So we're really excited at Utapils because we did our first Spring Frühlingsfest, which had been canceled last year. And so we kind of had planned it, and we were actually able to pull it off and happen a couple of weeks ago. And we just did a craft market at the brewery this past weekend, and we're doing a couple of charity events this weekend. But rolling forward, now that we know we can have kind of larger events and we kind of tested out the process, we're going to be doing what we call our Artapils. So it's our be our fifth annual Artapils. And so we have music and artists who come and sell their wares. So it's a chance for people to come and have a great time. And there's family friendly with no cover charge. The music's free. And you can shop and you can just enjoy yourself. We will also be doing a return of Kielbasa Fest, which we've been kind of partnering with Kramarczyk's, the Polish deli over in Northeast. They used to do the event, and it just got so big they couldn't handle it in their parking lot, so they kind of stopped doing it, and we've been doing some things with them over the last year and a half, and so they wanted to bring back the concept of Kielbasa Fest, and we offered our place up for it, and they jumped on board. And by the way, if you like meat raffles, if you're a true Minnesotan and you like going and winning free meat at a beer place, we do that the last Tuesday of every month. And it's free. You don't even have to buy your tickets. We give it to you.
Oh, wow.
And we have fun with that. And then, of course, we will be doing two weekends of Oktoberfest, which will be at the traditional dates. And then after that, we will be doing a Jule Market. In the November, December timeframe, we're still debating on the weekend, but it's a chance, kind of a Scandinavian winter market. And, you know, we've done that now for 3 years. And again, there'll be music and dancers and beer and crafts and all kinds of fun stuff.
Excellent.
Wow. And all right, Aaron, what do we have on top?
And that leads nicely into the GI events. And what is fabulous is that the Utapils, the Oktoberfest at Utapils, is not the same weekend as the GI Oktoberfest. So listeners can go to all of the Oktoberfests in the area. So yeah, I wanted to point out for our listeners that our summer Café and Kuchen is back here at the house on Saturdays, beginning the Saturday after Deutsche Tage on June 19th. Come from 12 to 3. No reservations are required. Helga and her friends are making a whole assortment of delicious cake. You can have that with coffee or water. We also have our Stammtisch curbside. So we have a traditional German lunch that is prepared, and that will be on July 13th and August 10th. I think it is the second Tuesday of every month for $13, and it is a very big meal. And that leads me to our International Cafe on July 17th from 1 to 3 p.m. here at the house. We are partnering with another nonprofit, the Iraqi and American Reconciliation Project. So we are doing an Iraqi and German cultural celebration where we're having treats, Iraqi dancing, German cakes. And it's just going to be a really fun international celebration. So that's what we have going on this summer, as well as our German classes starting July 12th.
Should we talk about the cool kind of promotion that you are working on with Ken?
Yes. Yeah. So I think we came away from our meeting at Utapils, my business meeting.
Yes. At 3 p.m. on a Wednesday.
At 3 p.m. on a Wednesday.
We found a beer.
Yeah.
Okay. So what is the collaboration about? What are we looking at? What is the project?
Yeah. Well, I think we came out of that meeting with like 100 good ideas. So now it's really a matter of just sort of narrowing it down with Ken and your team over at Utapils, but we would like to do some German trivia nights. We might do a Schnupper chorus where folks can try out learning German. It's not as scary as everyone thinks. It's actually fun, and it's also easier. And Gunter is one of our fabulous teachers, by the way. And we were looking at having some pop-ups over at Utapils and having you and your beer visit the GAI more often. So we're excited.
It's really a good idea to have a beer on standby during a German class. Just saying. I mean, not at the house, but particularly for those who participate via Zoom, because it's cold, right out of the fridge, ready for you.
It takes a stress level down to make people more comfortable it trying things does. That they're not comfortable saying yet.
It does.
Yeah. And all right. Our sampler course, the theme of our sampler course is all about being at a beer garden or a party. So it fits perfectly.
Well, I think with this, we'll wrap it up. this was a little bit a different start than usual. And a lot of it I'm probably going to leave in, just simply to show you that, no, we are not as always curated and reasonably smooth. Every once in a while, behind the scenes, there are a couple of, just call them mess-ups. Dan, thank you so much for coming in.
No, thank you. This was a wonderful experience, which is what
appreciate
we all
that. And Erin, as always, thank you so much. And I think, you know, in summary, what really stood out to me was A, beer is great, experience is better, but above all, and I think now particularly going into post-COVID, local collaboration is going to get us all to recover much better, much faster. With that being said, thanks so much for being with us. Until next time, this is Günther signing off. Tschüss.